Explore the night skies with our large range of high-quality telescopes. Whether you're a novice or an astronomy expert, we have the right telescope for you in our Australian Geographic e-store. Explore the whole range and find the right telescope for you today. Go to www.australiangeographic.com.au/shop. That's www.australiangeographic.com.au/shop. Hi, I'm Angela Heathcote and this is Talking Australia, a podcast by Australian Geographic.
Justin Gilligan is an award-winning Australian Geographic photojournalist who was recently sent out to Port Phillip Bay just off Melbourne to document the march of the spider crabs. A natural spectacle, the enormous crabs congregate to avoid predation, but now they're facing an all-new threat. So I'm really excited to be talking to Justin on this episode of Talking Australia. Just to clarify, this podcast was recorded remotely due to COVID-19. So for the newest issue of Australian Geographic, you've travelled to Port Phillip Bay in Victoria and you photographed and documented the march of the spider crabs. The images were spectacular, but paint a picture for me of what exactly you saw down there.
Yeah, well, Ange, it's generally speaking, it's a pretty easy and accessible site to dive. So all you have to do is sort of park your car near a jetty, fairly close to the site, gear up at the back of your car, and then just wander off the shore straight under a jetty. And it's pretty sheltered. There's not much current, not much swell. So it's really nice and easy diving. And anyone can really do it, whether you're a scuba diver or a snorkeler. And often you can just see the crabs walking along the jetty, which is great. So the sites themselves are pretty great sites in their own right without the spider crabs. The jetty pylons are covered in sort of really beautiful invertebrate growth. There's lots of seahorses and different species of crabs and sea slugs living amongst that sort of invertebrate growth. Then you sort of look around the scene and there's light filtering through the deck of the jetty, and yeah, it's sort of creating laser beam patterns on the seafloor, which is really nice to see. And then after a bit of a swim, you sort of start to see groups of crabs. And then eventually there's like hundreds and sometimes even thousands of crabs covering the seafloor, and they're sort of, some are piled up in groups of like 5 or 10 on the seafloor, and then they're all the way up the piles and under the jetty structure. So it's a pretty spectacular scene, and you can sort of swim out from underneath the jetty and look up, and you can see people fishing and see people looking down at you or looking down at the strange dark shape glowing bubbles underneath. So it's a really beautiful place to explore, but especially great when there's this mass aggregation of crabs happening.
And why is it that they aggregate there?
So the crabs mostly live at much greater depths outside of Port Phillip Bay in Bass Strait. And so sort of generally speaking, they enter the bay in smaller groups. And then the smaller groups start to gather, and the small groups sort of get bigger and bigger until you get the mass aggregations. And by aggregating en masse, the crabs are seeking safety in numbers. So crustaceans have a hard body armor, like an exoskeleton, which they need to shed to allow them to grow. So the crabs molt all at once over a period of a few days. In total, it takes a single crab about an hour to molt, and then there's another 3 days after they molt where they're quite susceptible to predation because their shells are really soft and take 3 days to harden. And during that time, they're susceptible to predation by stingrays, seals, and octopus. So they just can't seem to get enough soft-shelled crabs. So many end up being eaten by the predators, but because the numbers are so great, most survive, and then they're able to make their way back into Bass Strait.
And obviously in a lot of the images that you had taken, there were things like stingrays and, all these different predators. I mean, what was it like seeing that in action, like all these predators come and feasting on these very vulnerable crabs?
Yeah, so that was pretty amazing, and it was, I think, as an underwater photographer, that's kind of what you're after. You're trying to find some type of interesting behavior a lot of the time. And yeah, I was just fortunate enough to time it well. It doesn't really last that long. It lasts for a week or two, possibly the peak of the action at the most. And so the crabs move in, and that's when the stingrays come in, and it's one or two at the start, but then there can be 12 around at a time swimming through this massive spider crabs. And they're like giant sort of creepy crawlies in a pool, sort of just going up the side of the walls of the pool and just moving through this massive crabs trying to find the soft-shelled crab. But it's just really amazing to see that unusual behavior, because the stingrays are just so big. They're about 4 meters long and 2 meters wide, and they're the largest species of stingray in Australian waters. So it's quite a spectacle to see, and to time it to be right in the middle of that is just an amazing thing to experience.
I just want to go into the timing of it. Obviously, what I like so much about your photography in particular is that it does capture those incredible animal behaviours. So I'm wondering, what goes into the planning of a shoot like this, and what kind of gear did you use at the time as well?
I think in terms of planning, the critical thing was to try and stay connected with the local dive community down in Port Phillip Bay. Because it's so variable, this event sort of happens between April and June for a couple of weeks every year. So it's a fairly sort of large window. So I don't really have the ability to go to a place for 3 months and just wait for this to happen. So what I need to do is stay in contact with the local dive community down there and just, try and ask them to let me know once the action starts, and I'll try and take that risk and get there to try and be there during the peak of the action. So that was one of the critical things about the planning. And then in terms of diving, as I said before, it's pretty straightforward diving when the weather's suitable. So you can dive off the shore, which is really useful and easy to do, and it sort of takes the problematic sort of aspects of boats and trying to time the weather sort of to get offshore out of it, which is good. And then also working from shore, you have the ability to sort of change lenses easily in between dives. So underwater you can't really change lenses because your camera's in an underwater housing. I have my underwater housing with SLR inside that, protected from the water, and then using external strobes as like artificial light, because it's quite dark under the superstructure itself. And so then in between dives I can change lenses to try and get more close shots or stick to sort of wider shots. And so it's really, really easy diving like that, which is good. And the other critical thing that I really needed down there was a really thick wetsuit, because the water gets down to it was about 12 degrees when I was there, so it's a little bit chilly, but I was fortunate enough to use a dry suit this time around, so that allows you to remain sort of nice and toasty, and you can wear tracksuit pants and a jumper and sort of different layers underneath the dry suit to keep yourself warm.
And what were some of the challenges once you were down there, and how long were you down there for to actually take the photos?
So each dive, you can actually dive for quite a while down there, because it's kind of shallow under these jetties where the spider crabs take shelter. So it's only sort of 3 to 5 meters deep where the spider crabs are, and that means you're not restricted for time. You don't really have to think about sort of the issues around repetitive dives and things like that. So you can really stay as long as your tank will last and as long as you can stand the temperature, really. So I would do a 2-hour dive on average. And the best lights are early in the morning or late in the afternoon. So try and do 3 dives a day. So 1 early in the morning, 1 in the middle of the day, and then a dive in the late afternoon. So 3 2-hour dives in a day down there, which sort of gives you plenty of time underwater. But, it's just trying to keep away the cold. That was the biggest challenge.
And just taking you back to 2017 when you won the Australian Geographic Nature Photographer of the Year Award, that was obviously for a picture of spider crabs. Do you think that spider crabs are maybe a returning subject for you?
Well, that's it. I definitely hope so, Ange, like, because they're just so interesting and amazing to, just watch, and just the unusual behaviours associated with them are, just means that they're really interesting to photograph and really interesting to observe. And then once you have like hundreds or even thousands of crabs in one spot, that in itself is quite a spectacle. But then you sort of introduce a predator such as the big smooth rays down in Port Phillip Bay or the Maori octopus from Tasmania, then just to see that interaction between the predators and the spider crabs is just something that's just so intriguing and entertaining and just such a challenge to photograph. So I definitely hope that spider crabs will be a reoccurring theme in my work in the future.
Subscribe to our AG magazine for 6 months for just $30 and save 33% on the newsstand price. That's 3 issues of our award-winning magazine delivered to your home for just $30. Plus, you will also receive exclusive benefits, including 10% off all products purchased in our e-store. So don't wait. Go to www.australiangeographic.com.au/talkingaustralia for our special offer. That's www.australiangeographic.com.au/talkingaustralia.
In the article, you mentioned the work of the Spider Crab Alliance. Can you kind of talk me through, what their role is and also the conservation issues facing the spider crabs at Port Phillip Bay?
Yeah, so this was a relatively new threat that kind of started last year during the aggregation. I was there actually covering the aggregation last year. And, the word had gotten out that there were soft-shell crabs available to catch under the jetty. And it's not something that's kind of been on people's radars previously. And so word spread throughout the fishing community that there was easy access to these soft-shelled crabs that had freshly molted under the jetty. And, so that sort of brought the fishers and, sort of increased that fishing pressure on the aggregation under the jetty. And the problem there is that the aggregation's widely known. It's on the doorstep of our second biggest city. The dive community's sort of all over it. So when the spider crabs are in the area, sort of everyone knows they're there. The dive shops are receiving payment from divers that are coming there to hire tanks and hire gear. The divers are there to actually enjoy the crabs. So for them to see the crabs getting taken out, the same ones that they're underwater looking at, that was a bit of a shock to the local community. So they decided to form the Spider Crab Alliance in response to that. So it's actually legal to capture crabs using the traps that they were using, and you can take 30 crabs a day. But I guess those regulations weren't really put in place to manage like a mass aggregation in one location. And it's just that conflict of different uses that forced this community group to come up and raise their concern. So they put together the Spider Crab Alliance, and what they are hoping to do with that is to draw attention to the issue. They've also started a petition, which people can get online and check that out at change.org. And so their ultimate goal is to increase awareness and then gain support for the spider crabs of the area, and then sort of take their proposals to government in the hope to sort of change the rules and regulations about spider crabs. And there's some specific things that they're actually looking at doing. They want to see an increase in research into spider crabs, which is fair enough because there's not a whole heap known. They'd like a seasonal ban on collecting, for example, which is probably fair enough due to those conflicting uses. They are fairly widespread, the spider crabs, But yeah, it's just that sort of conflicting use within that specific area that's the problem. So if all the spider crabs get taken out from that one sort of location, then maybe the spider crabs won't return to that same location next year. It may not impact the overall population of spider crabs in southern Australian waters, but it could potentially impact this this spectacle that people come and see. And I guess some of the other things they're asking for is increased compliance action and increased education for fishers through signage and things like that.
I think it's a really interesting conundrum that you you mentioned that, you know, it's sort of a recent issue in that people only have been only doing it over the last, you know, a certain period of time. And I feel like I first heard about spider crabs from The Magical Land of Oz, the documentary on the ABC. And it's kind of like that Nemo effect where people finally learn about these incredible creatures and these incredible, this incredible natural phenomena, but then maybe like it doesn't always serve the species. Have you come across that in your work at any time, or just like more broadly?
I think so. I think I definitely think that's like a reoccurring theme, and I think that I think the spider crabs have got a lot of exposure through Blue Planet 2, for example. That was a big one. So there's a lot of support behind them. But I think that sometimes when a particular area or a particular event is sort of promoted through a documentary or through social media or through any other means really, then it can cause a problem, and it can just cause a problem through sort of too much tourism. If it's sort of unregulated and not managed properly, then yeah, just having a lot of people in one location to even observe like an interesting animal behavior or something can impact on that animal. So I think it's definitely not a new thing, and there's lots of examples of that throughout Australia and the world. And I guess that's why sort of codes of practice for whale watching and interacting with whale sharks and things like that come about, because of those potential impacts from us even just going to appreciate things, let alone us sort of going to catch things and eat them.
And just going back to, just even the fact that you've mentioned the Spider Crab Alliance in your article, I'm wondering, you know, you could have just as easily written like just a beautiful natural history piece that sort of left them out and left out the conservation issues. I'm wondering, like, what responsibility do you have or do you feel as a photojournalist to include those things and make sure, those sort of conservation stories are a part of the storytelling as well?
Well, I think it's a critical part of it, really. And I think that a lot of my stuff is the interaction between people and the natural environment. So this was something that was just obviously occurring when I sort of visited the site. So it wasn't really well known then, but it was just something that was happening, and I was sort of taken aback by it. And I just thought that was a critical interaction that I had to let people know about. And just because there was more and more sort of interest and more people signing the petition and more people concerned, then that was even more of a reason to sort of get this message out there and sort of try and get more people involved, more people educated about the issue, and more people to get behind the Spider Crab Alliance.
And what do you have coming up in terms of projects?
I have another feature coming up with Australian Geographic on the same sort of thing, the interaction between people and the marine environment of Moreton Bay. I'd done a similar piece to that in the Sydney region. So it's kind of a follow-on from that, I guess. So it looks at some of those amazing environmental and ecological values that we have right on the doorstep of some of our largest cities. So similar to the Port Phillip Bay piece, but just looking at some of those amazing things that are just outside our doorstep there that people might not know about, that that are just underwater, sight unseen. But yeah, there's just these crazy things happening just offshore. So I guess there's the great ecological and environmental values that's going to form part of that piece. But there's also the hardworking research that's happening in that area as well by a number of different marine researchers and conservationists as well, working to sort of maintain the health of their own backyard. And I guess ultimately, telling that story is just about sort of educating people about the threats that come from threats to the marine environment from the nearby city environment, but also, you know, it's paying respect to those people working to conserve those areas or promote awareness for those areas. So, yeah, that's a piece that I have coming up that I'm pretty excited about, which is great.
I have to say, as a Sydney-sider and reading your piece on the kind of sea life in Sydney Harbour and seeing kind of like, I think it was like a Tui's can with like a guppy or like some sort of fish coming out of it. It was really, really incredible just because I guess I had kind of not thought about the marine life in Sydney Harbour because I just thought of it as this really kind of like as dirty, like what would live in there kind of thing. How important is it to make people aware of, you know, this marine life around them? How important is that to kind of build those connections and make people understand? And what impacts do you see that having?
I just think it's really important. Like, and it's just, it sort of comes back to decisions that we can make in our sort of everyday lives. This is an extreme example, but someone may like throw a piece of trash away or discard a piece of litter and not really think about it. But hopefully, like if they see the pictures and read the story then and hear about the work of conservation groups going on to help clean up and protect certain areas, then I hope that would make them realise that that's a potential threat by them doing that. So, maybe they should put that in the bin, or maybe people should try and make more informed decisions on the type of just retail items that they buy. So items with less plastic, so there's less risk of that material entering the waterway, or sort of different chemicals that they use for washing their car or washing their car in the gutter as opposed to on a lawn. Sort of just being aware of certain issues. And I just think it's important to try and capture images that make people sort of stop and want have a think about things. And that's the challenge, I think, of being an underwater photographer, just trying to come up with something that is kind of interesting enough or pretty enough or engaging enough to make people sort of stop and look and read more and hopefully learn from that. So I think it's definitely critical to get those stories out there.
And now I have to ask, you've relocated to Lord Howe Island, I think it was last year for work, so I need to know, how is it living out my dream life?
Well, it's pretty much as you imagined it, and sorry, I wish that I could say that it was terrible, but it is, Lord Howe Island is just such an amazing place, and it's the benefit of just having time to explore the marine environment of Lord Howe Island is just that it's so healthy and pristine, and there's not many sort of impacts from people here because there's a limited number of people, and there has been some issues in relation to sort of warming seas and coral bleaching. But the reefs recovered quite well. That was a couple of years ago from that. But that is an emerging threat that could potentially impact the reef here in the future. But just seeing, like being able to explore a shallow lagoon like Lord Howe Island Lagoon with this unusual mix of tropical and marine species and, just a mix of seaweed and coral and the beautiful colours and crystal clear water is a dream. So, sorry for that bad news, Ange, but that's it.
Well, as usual, it's been lovely speaking to you, Justin. Thanks so much for coming on Talking Australia.
Thanks so much, Ange. Appreciate it.
That's it for today's episode of Talking Australia. If you have questions or comments, feel free to reach out. Write us an email, podcast@australiangeographic.com, or find us on Instagram @AustralianGeographic. And if you go to australiangeographic.com.au/talkingaustralia, you'll find a special subscription offer. So don't wait. Go to australiangeographic.com.au/talkingaustralia. Also, make sure to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts from. Thanks for listening. Until next time.